So the term is translated for this time only, or never again, one chance in a lifetime. And the term is a reminder to cherish any gathering that they may take part in, citing the fact that meetings in life are never repeated, that each moment is always once in a lifetime. And so often when sanghas gather, when retreats come together, you know, when people come together, sometimes we'll say this constellation will never reform exactly as it is. So let's appreciate and cherish this constellation, because in recognizing the impermanence of it, we have a much deeper appreciation. And that's so true of so much in life, right? And I think often it goes unnoticed. And so that's why this particular phrase is really touches me. And it's often spoken of around gatherings where people get together to share food, for instance. And I think about, I don't know how many times I have been to a restaurant and gotten a really great entree and went back again, and it was not the same. It was not repeated. And, you know, that wish for it to be just the way it was before. And yet so often it's not, you know, and it's that kind of deeper gratitude. And thinking of, like, and I'm sure some of y'all have had the same experience, just before the COVID shutdown, you know, we knew we had to shut down, and everybody was thinking, well, it's going to be for a couple of months and, you know, we'll all be back together. And of course, as we all know, that's not at all how it turned out. And during that longer period, you know, although we did reform online, you know, there was a real shift in the constellation of our community, for instance. Some people kind of went away and quit practicing, and then other people came, and there was a complete change in the community, you know, and it was not expected at the time, or even realizing or seeing that there was a certain kind of ending that was happening, and that was not going to come back again in the same way, which is really so much about how life is. And yet it's often not seen. You know, sometimes it just isn't seen that this is not going to be repeated, or this won't be the same. There's something in the mind that has a hard time really seeing that. You know, it's almost like we almost anticipate that things are going to stay the same, or expect, you know. And I remembered, you know, Nashville, this was over a decade ago, we had a historic flood here that was catastrophic. It was a catastrophic level of destruction that happened here. And one of my favorite parks that was very close to my house, our house was fine, but the park was just literally 2 or 3 minutes from here. And I'd spent so many years hiking a certain path and a certain trail time and time again. It was almost like it became a part of my body. I knew it so well. And this flood destroyed that path. And when it was reformed, it was a completely different path. It took a different direction. The terrain was different. And I remember the first time when I walked that path, and I just felt a moment of sadness, because it's like the last time I walked the other path, I had no idea that it was the last time. It was something that simply disappeared, and I didn't know it. I didn't see it. And there was a really profound sense of gratitude that came up for something that was gone, but that, you know, had meant so much to me and hadn't even known that it was going to end. And so a question is, what keeps us from this recognition sometimes? What is it? You know, one of the things that Buddha talks about is the distortion of perception. That is, taking what is impermanent to be permanent, what is not self to be self, and what is suffering we take as not suffering, which is the three marks of existence. And so speaking particularly of impermanence, so the distortion of perception is the mind tends to believe things are going to last that are impermanent. And it happens time and again. I think it's just the way the mind works. And not to be so unkind about it, but just to acknowledge and recognize that this is part of what the understanding from the Buddha and the teachings. And I'll just share this quote from Ajahn Chah. So Ajahn Chah, before saying a word, motioned to a glass at his side. "Do you see this glass?" he asks us. "I love this glass. It holds the water admirably. When the sun shines on it, it reflects the light beautifully. When I tap it, it has a lovely ring. Yet for me, this glass is already broken. When the wind knocks it over or my elbow knocks it off the shelf and it falls to the ground and shatters, I say, of course. But when I understand that this glass is already broken, every minute with it is precious. And so I think that impermanence is a proximate cause for gratitude. And often the awareness of that can get lost, and yet it's there, you know. And for many years, I was a visual artist, and what I did, I painted for a livelihood. And one of the things I loved to paint was flowers. And people would always say, well, what is it about flowers that you love so much? And I said, because they die so quickly. They're so beautiful. And if it was a plastic flower that lived forever, there would be no gratitude, no beauty, no appreciation. The beauty and the impermanence are intertwined. They can't be taken apart. And the beauty of the flower then lies, a lot of it, in the fact that it doesn't live very long. It's impermanent. And so that gratitude, that appreciation arises out of that. And there was somebody just recently who died that I had met maybe a decade ago. And he was a young man. I think when he was diagnosed with a brain tumor in his 20s, and he had been able to have it operated on, and he was able to get back out, and he was teaching, you know, and he came to Nashville and he gave a talk, and he, you know, I connected with him a little bit, and he had suggested maybe we teach together sometime. It never really happened, but I did know over the last few years that his health started to fail again, and that his, you know, the brain tumor was coming back, and, you know, he was documenting his journey, but his whole focus in his life was that of gratitude and appreciating what he had. And he was always kind of teaching about it and offering his awareness of his impermanence. You know, the fact that he knew very clearly that he was going to die young. And I don't even know if he was 40. He just died. He just died recently. And he died young, but he really, his intention was to live this life of awareness and gratitude. And one thing that I think is very interesting about this is that, like, every year we celebrate our birthday. We know our birth date. Every year we pass through our death date, but we just don't know it yet. And yet that date already exists. You know, it's kind of like Ajahn Chah's glass that's already broken. You know, somehow we don't quite see it, and yet it's there. And there's a Zen teacher that I want to quote here. His name is Sohaku Okamura, and he's speaking about impermanence here. Seeing impermanence is not a negative thing in Buddhism, even though we feel sad. It is a good chance to arouse the Bodhi mind and aspire to practice what the Buddha taught. As Shakyamuni Buddha said in the Sutra on the Buddha's bequeathed teaching, within the practice, the Buddha's indestructible Dharma body is actualized. In the beginning of the Shobogenzo, Dogen said, therefore, flowers fall even though we love them. Weeds grow even though we dislike them. Since the wind's nature is ever present, the wind of the Buddha's family enables us to realize the gold of the great earth and to transform it into the long river into cream. By seeing reality beyond our self-centered desire expectation, we see our lives are connected with all beings. And of course, this is a powerful teaching from Thich Nhat Hanh. You know, when we move beyond what we cling to, we see this deep sense of interconnection. And to me, that is part of the three marks, and even looking at impermanence, because this self that we hold on to and we think of as separate, that separates us from the interconnection, is something too that's completely impermanent. You know, there's no way we can hold on to the self and make it be what we want it to be or command it to be solid and fixed. It just doesn't happen. And so that in and of itself shows us a place where if we begin to see the fluidity, we can see the connection, this deep interconnection that we have with all others. And one of the translations of dukkha is actually, or suffering, is being separated from the whole. And sometimes it's hard to appreciate a moment when we're suffering. And I really want to acknowledge that, whether emotional or physical, it's very hard to be not separated from the whole in moments of pain, in moments of difficulty. And when we have shame or loneliness, or we have physical pain, or our hearts feel cut off or separate, you know, in those moments, it's hard to appreciate. And sometimes the practice in those moments instead is simply compassion for what's hard. You know, it's a few years ago, I had an unexpected injury and I busted my knee really badly. And while nothing was broken, I was in this, it's nerve pain that I had, just excruciating nerve pain. And during that time when I was having this excruciating nerve pain, I couldn't be fully present in the midst of it. You know, it was just, I could only be on the periphery. And so what I found was, in recognizing that I couldn't be totally present and appreciating of the moment, I could be kind to myself in that pain and in that suffering. And then there was slowly a reopening back into presence and into connection. But during those moments of being separated from the whole, this practice of simply being kind is a step back and yet a step into. You know, as the Buddha taught, he said, you know, if you can't meet your experience with wisdom, and we could say meeting our experience with wisdom would be seeing the three marks, then meet it with compassion. And there are times when, even when we can't meet our experience with compassion, we simply need to divert and distract ourselves until we can come back and be present. In other words, sometimes it's too much. And I think those are important points, even in this teaching of presence, because we're not going to be present all the time. We may learn to really inhabit presence in a more deep and authentic way in our lives, but there's still going to be times when we simply can't. And for me, you know, I got my first lesson, deep lesson of impermanence, as a teenager, because by the time I was 16, both of my parents were already dead. They both died in their 40s. And so I was only, my mom died when I was 13, my dad died when I was 16. And I remember being thrown into the most profound confusion about life. Like, how in the world could this happen? You know, how could they be gone? You know, I wasn't even an adult yet. You know, my parents weren't there to raise me. And I wound up taking an elective course in high school on Zen Buddhism. And I heard, for the first time in my life, I heard the quote of Buddha around impermanence, the teachings of impermanence. And it's something that none of us escape, that it's a intrinsic part of being human and life. And when I heard those words, my heart opened. And that was the moment when I knew the Dharma would be my path. I absolutely knew in that moment, when Buddha's words penetrated my heart and helped me to see that the suffering I was experiencing wasn't just about me, that it was the human condition. And even though it happened to me at an unusual time, it happened to me very young. It happens to everybody. We all lose people we love. We all experience these changes and this loss in life. And for me, just having a moment of seeing this broader view of life gave my heart peace. Now, it's not to say that I didn't have a great deal of grieving in front of me and a lot more to get to where I could really embrace the teaching, but it was the beginning point. And that was something that really helped me to begin to move into the path. And so sometimes, you know, we feel a sense of groundlessness, and it can be hard to inhabit and appreciate the moment when it feels that the rug is coming out from under. I think this happened for a lot of people during COVID. And, you know, we think about, you know, a refuge, a physical home, a place that we can really inhabit our lives are important. People who are refugees, who have no homes, people who are living in war, you know, it's finding gratitude and appreciation under those circumstances is really not going to happen in the same way. And yet, you know, so having something that's a little, that's more grounding is something vital to the development, including our spiritual development. But yet we can also work with groundlessness. You know, during COVID, there was such a profound sense of change and of groundlessness. And I talked a lot about it. And I remembered a quote, and this was, I was meeting, I don't know if some of you heard of David Loy. He's a Zen teacher. He's got, he's out in Colorado, but he was coming to give a talk. He was a guest speaker at One Dharma, my organization. And we were having lunch, and I was telling him about a trip that was coming up where somebody was going to take me up in their Cessna, and I was going to overlook the mountains, you know, and it was driving, you know, flying all the way from Nashville to Asheville. And David Loy made a joke about how his wife would never allow herself to step into a single engine plane, which was exactly what I was going to get into. And I'd never been into one before. And I have to admit that made me a little bit afraid. But then he reminded me of a quote, and it's, "You're falling out of an airplane. The bad news is there is no parachute. The good news is there is no ground." And so the reality in this life is that the ground that we think we have is not so solid. And how do we navigate that terrain? Now, I remembered a therapist who I went to when my life was going through this massive change. And I said, "I feel like I have no place to hold as home. There was no place to step, no place to be." And he said, you need to learn to walk where there is no ground. So that was what I began to practice, finding a ground or a home in the very place that felt that there was no place to land, to put my feet. And that's not such an easy thing to do, but there is a possibility. And out of that can arise gratitude. And there was a retreat that I went to a number of years ago where we would do these walking meditations, and we would go barefoot. And this was when I was in the Zen tradition. I spent about 10 years in Zen before I switched over to the Insight tradition. But one of the things we would do was take off our socks, and we would do this walking meditation as a group where we would start inside and go outside. And this was up in the upper mountains of New Mexico, and it would get really cold in the morning. And there was this point at which I would always inevitably step into wet, this really cold water when we were outside on the deck. And I would always brace myself, you know, and kind of dread putting my foot into that cold water, because it just would, you know, kind of run through my body, you know. And finally I said to myself, what if I consciously put my foot into the water without the armoring, without the aversion, without the resistance? What if I just put my foot in the water? And so the next time that we did the walk, I consciously, as I knew I was coming to the water, I simply opened myself to allow my foot to go into the water and feel it completely, letting this moment be the only moment. And as I put my foot into the water, one of the things that happened was it didn't feel nearly as cold or miserable. When the resistance was gone, it was just cold. It was just water. But I think the more important thing was that the minute my foot touched the water, I felt a profound sense of gratitude for being alive and being present and able and allowing myself to be fully with a moment. It may not have been a beautiful moment in what we usually think of as beauty, but yet in that openness of touching the water in that way, my heart was open. And I felt a deep sense of appreciation for that moment and was able to really allow myself to experiencing that fully. And so, you know, some questions would be, you know, how do we work with this? You know, how do we really cultivate this awareness, you know, recognizing the three marks and how they interact and how these teachings play together and how even the distortion of perception, you know, seeing what's our perception of seeing permanence where there is impermanence, or seeing suffering, or seeing not suffering where there's suffering, and seeing self where there's not self. You know, how do we see this? And often in meditation, You know, for me, there is a process of opening my heart, you know, to whatever presents itself to me in the moment, in whatever way I can. I mean, most of us, I think, do that, and not to fix or hold on to either a moment of suffering, a moment of joy, but, you know, watching and seeing the constant flow and seeing it with compassion. For me, stepping back, you know, there's a teaching in Zen of taking a backward step. Some of you may have heard of that, where you literally take a step back into the immediacy of your experience, the way it is. So it's almost like leaning back a little bit. So the backward step is we're letting go of the self that's striving, that's pushing forward, that's trying to accomplish something. Not to say that cultivation and meditation doesn't have its value, but the stepping back into the immediacy of our experience really allows the heart to open. It allows us to really feel and know this moment just as it is, knowing that it's going to continuously change. And I think when that grasping and when that kind of striving that is often there is released, then there's a far greater ability to really know this experience of presence and these moments that never come again, these constant moments. You know, it's like we've had here in Nashville, we've had months of just sweltering heat. And this weekend, we finally had some cool weather, and it felt so joyful, you know, to experience change and to experience the shifting after what felt interminable, just the endless heat. And yet, even in the endless heat, you know, there's this quality of knowing and presence and opening the heart, knowing that it too changes. You know, so the good news of it, there's good news of impermanence and bad news of impermanence, right? I mean, the good things change, the bad things change. And I there's a quote that makes me think of this experience from Sylvia Boorstein. You know, may I meet this moment fully, may I meet it as a friend. You know, it sounds simple, and yet to really do that, you know, how do we really meet these moments as a friend? And again, I want to say sometimes we can't. And when we can't, then may I meet it with compassion and kindness, you know, so that we have some room to know our experience, but also not to fixate so hard that, well, I should always be present, I should always be kind, I should always appreciate. But then finding that, I think, opens the door. And I do know that, you know, just to one final point that I'd like to make is that, you know, I went through a time in my life, and this was, I was still in Zen at the time, and I hadn't started practicing the Brahmaviharas yet. And I didn't know much about them. And I was feeling really very dissatisfied about my life. And I was talking to my teacher about this, and he had just begun to learn the Brahmaviharas himself. And he made a suggestion to me that was two-pronged. And one, he said, was to practice mudita, sympathetic joy. And at that time in my life, I didn't even know what that was. You know, how do I offer gratitude for the joy of another person? And so it was something I really had to cultivate. How do I find gratitude for those that seem to be having all the good fortune that I wish I had? But what I also did was I did a deep practice of my own life in meditation of gratitude. And what I did, it wasn't just the check off the box type of gratitude, but this was like sitting and really taking that backward step into my immediate experience, into my heart, moving the attention down into my body, and then asking as an inquiry, what do I have to be grateful for? Where is my gratitude? And so it was a deep, heartfelt question that my heart answered. It wasn't mental. And as my heart began to show me what I had to be grateful for, my heart became so much more full. And I began to be able to offer this mudita to friends and people who I felt had so much more than me. It really changed the course of my life. And I stopped feeling jealous. I stopped feeling less than. I started to appreciate my life as it was. And I could appreciate the good fortune and the joy of others. And so it was a real turning point for me in this deep sense of appreciation. And of course, the teaching of impermanence, being that everything changes, their lives changed, mine changed, none of it was permanent. And yet I could at least in those moments, you know, find joy and gratitude, and even moving out of the dukkha of separation, the dukkha of being separated from the whole, as I found this gratitude, this joy for my friends who were having good fortune, that sense of interconnection opened up, and the dukkha, the suffering of feeling disconnected and separate began to fall away. And it opened my heart in a way that really, really changed my life and set me on a different course. That's when I began the insight tradition and began to really cultivate the Brahma Viharas a lot more deeply. So I think I am going to close the talk there and would like to open it for comments or questions. Is it Nancy?
It is. I'm trying to get my mechanical hand. Oh, anyway, you already saw me. You know, I really appreciated your sharing your life and how you found the path and the suffering that brought you there. And I was thinking as you were talking, I believed, it was like the second arrow, I believed, even though I was a Buddha student, I believed that my husband would outlive me. Mm. His parents had lived to be 88 and 98. And I just, I believed it. So it added to, it was, the suffering was intensified because of that belief. I mean, there was the missing him, and that was, you know, just what happens as it is. But the second part, you know, I just didn't look at him as the glass that could break. Mm. I really thought, I didn't believe that. So anyway, I was just reflecting on that as you were talking.
Mm. Mm. Thank you. And I'm sorry for your loss. Thank you. Yeah. Mm. Mm. Yes, Bowman?
Yeah, thanks, Lisa. A really great talk. You know what one of the points that you made that you know, if we can't be in the present moment due to the pain that you were talking about, the pain that you were in, that you could at least be kind. You could be kind to yourself and to be kind in the I don't know how did you say that in being kind. I just it just rung for me. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah, it's, you know, it's almost like, you know, it's being kind to the pain, and it, that could be both the, if it's physical pain or emotional pain. In other words, to bring a little kindness to ourselves when we think we should be doing it a different way. You know, I should be able to be present. I should be able to be able, you know, I should be able to follow the Buddha's teachings just exactly. But sometimes we have to kind of step back into kindness instead and say, in this moment, this is what I can do. This is all I can do. And I'm going to be kind. You know, I'm going to be kind. I'm going to be compassionate. So the teaching was, you know, if you can't meet your experience with wisdom, meet it with compassion. And to me, that's a powerful teaching, because ultimately wisdom and compassion are play together. Yeah.
Yeah, that's great. Well, thank you very much. That's wonderful.
Patty?
Hi, Thank you, honey. So that was lovely. I want to just say I love that story about there's no parachute is the bad news, and the good news is there's no ground. Because I think I can apply that when I'm feeling fearful. Sometimes it feels like I'm falling without a parachute. But to remember that there's no ground, I have to think about it more. But I love the idea that there's no such thing as landing. We're just all in this spacious awareness together, and there's no real there. I
Yeah.
just love that story. The image is going to stay with me, and I'm going to use that. Thank you.
Ah, welcome. Thank you for where you shared that. That's nice. Thanks.
Liz, did you have something to say?
Oh, you caught me. It was a bit of what Patty was talking about. Is groundlessness a positive state in your mind? I know Pema Chodron talks about groundlessness all the time. And if there's no self, which I really don't believe, but there is a self at every moment, it can change, it will change. I believe there's no permanent self. But if it's groundless and there's no self, then how do I function?
Yeah, that's a good question. I've heard that one. I've heard that often too. And it is a great question. How do we function? I mean, I think that's actually, it's almost like a koan or a question. How do we function? How do we humans function when in fact we go through our lives with no guarantees, you know? And I mean, we can sort of count on things, but at the same time, just as Nancy shared, you know, what we think we can count on isn't always what we can count on. You know, life doesn't give us those guarantees. So that groundlessness is there, and the self that we try to count on really keeps slipping through our hands and changing. And so then how do we function? And I think it's almost as if the answer is in the question, in the sense that somehow we do function, even though there's this reality at the deeper level that maybe we don't see all the time. You know, that this ground that we think exists doesn't really exist in the way we see it, and the self doesn't exist, and yet we do function. It's like we show up, we're here, we live our lives, we're able to live and function even with this reality. So I think sometimes people will say to me, but if I go too far into no self and emptiness, I'm never going to come back, or I'm not going to be me. And what I always tell people is the ego is so persistent that it will come back, and and that sense of ground that we have is, you know, it's like we need, as I think, as I was mentioning, we need some, just to be able to even open to these teachings, we need some sense of stability. You know, people in war zones they're not going to be able to practice the Buddha's teachings, or most people aren't. Their lives are in a state of turmoil. So we do need some stability. But then out of that stability, we can really begin to see, you know, through this illusion of self, or through the illusion of ground. And it's like we're already living in it. And that could be a useful thing to say. We are already living in it, and somehow we're all still here, you know, and we're doing this life the best we can. And so it's like Ajahn Chah's glass that's already broken. You know, he has this glass that he drinks out of, and he loves it, and he thinks it's wonderful, but he also knows that it's already broken. And so I think that, you know, I think that groundlessness can feel scary, but I've also found that when I lean into it and I can kind of acclimate myself, it's incredibly liberating, because then what I'm trying to hold on to and cling to that really isn't working anyway, that isn't really giving me a true sense of stability. It's like, oh, I'm already free. I'm already liberated. This space of awareness is already holding me. And so that's been my response. So I don't know if that answered your question, or, you
Well,
know.
it helps. Also, I've been a person who was very involved with the self, many, many years of therapy and working on my personality and so, which were enormously important to me. But I didn't feel a sense of freedom until I came to Buddhism. Like the first noble truth, there is suffering. And I thought, oh, that's normal. But also, it's a paradox what you're talking about. And the way for me is I have a self that's impermanent and is constantly changing. And so in the moment of groundlessness, I have a self for that moment, but it's changing and growing. And that's helpful for me.
Yeah, not to go to complete emptiness where the self just
No.
dissolves completely.
Because I have to make choices, and my actions are based on those choices and the self at the moment.
Yeah, in the moment, that's it. It's, it was Suzuki Roshi said, there are no enlightened people,
Yeah.
only enlightened activity. So that speaks to your, it's the activity and it's not fixed and the self is not fixed. And so we can function. We can continue to function. Yeah, otherwise we wouldn't. And I see people who do get really caught in the dissolving of self and emptiness, and they can become so attached to that they kind of go off into their own little world and they become disconnected from life. I used to see students like that. They were so attached to the dissolving of self that they, in a lot of ways, it was a bypass of dealing with suffering.
Yes, there's pain in living.
Yeah.
Yes, thank you.
Let's see, Mary.
Yes, thank you very much for your talk this evening. Just lovely. And it made me think of some of my joyous moments of how to be there, really be there for them. And we're not talking about grandiose moments, this little sweet moments of my life that I know I'm not going to get back, to really appreciate them. And the other thing I really appreciate is that is mudita. Mudita has been fairly big part of my practice. I have a gratitude practice, and I agree. I think that mudita and gratitude really kind of ride together in a way, a really beautifully. I just remember, going to work sometimes, and if my life wasn't exactly how I wanted it or whatever, but just seeing, a parent and their child riding their bikes, and the smiles on their faces. I mean, it was just like, yeah, that love and joy, it was, I felt like I was just like, I was talking to a friend of mine, I felt like I was scooping it up. It's like scooping, because it wasn't like they were hoarding it. It was out there for everybody to share. And there's so many of those sweet, sweet moments. I mean, it can even be with my dogs when they're not being little knuckleheads. It is just such a good thing, because I think that the mind is so quick to look at things that need to be fixed, or to judge, or to compare, and to just observe in a given moment. There is such beauty and sweetness. And Gil Fronsdal, I just remember being on a retreat with him, just talking about looking at the beauty, with, like you said, with the flowers, whatever it is, just enjoying that, and being there for just all of those sweet moments. And it's a really good reminder. So thank you very much, Lisa. Appreciate it.